Hey, Up First listeners, it's Rachel, and we are here in your feed on a Sunday with a special report. Election Day is just weeks away, and millions of Americans have already voted. The team here at NPR has been digging in on all the issues surrounding voting in this year's election. That means talking about access to voting, disinformation, how to vote if you have yet to do so. So, from NPR's politics team, we present a special report from Juana Summers and Scott Detrow. Take a listen.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADP. With more than 70 years of experience helping businesses run smoothly, ADP helps clients navigate these complex times and compliance challenges so businesses can pay their people accurately and on time. More than a payroll company, ADP is HR, talent, time, benefits, and payroll, informed by data and designed for people. Support also comes from First Republic Bank. Safeguard your spending with the convenience of the redesigned First Republic mobile app. Visit firstrepublic.com/digital to learn more. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm really glad they did this early voting so that I could actually come out and like spend my day doing this.
The 2020 election is taking place during a global pandemic, a vicious political season, and increasingly amid an unprecedented lack of trust in the voting system. I'm Scott Detrow, along with Juana Summers. This hour, we'll hear from election officials.
All of us take the responsibility of conducting elections on behalf of our state seriously.
Experts weigh in on the risks of voting in person.
It can be safe even for people who are high risk, who are elderly. There are ways of making it a very low-risk activity.
We'll answer your questions about mail-in ballots, drop boxes, poll watchers, and we'll tell you what a naked ballot is and how to avoid it. This is a special report from NPR News on voting in America. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Over the next hour, we're going to take a look at the most consequential part of the upcoming 2020 election, the act of voting.
A highly divisive election, complicated and disparate voting rules, and of course, the coronavirus pandemic have combined to make voting itself a central issue this year.
We'll talk about disinformation, answer questions about the voting process, and take a look at what's different this year.
We're going to start with Miles Parks, who's been reporting on voting security all year as part of NPR's election security team.
Hello.
Miles, what is different about the level of misinformation and disinformation this election cycle?
You know, we think about 2016 as an election year when everyone really started thinking about misinformation as an election topic. That same kind of environment is still around. You know, the internet is still where this stuff is going to breed. And people have only been online more over the last year as this pandemic has taken hold, obviously. The other thing to think about is that there's two things that misinformation really feeds on that this election has a lot of. The first is rapid changes. And, you know, obviously, if you've been following court battles around this country, election rules have been changing what feels like every day, at least every week or every month in a lot of states. A lot of potential for bad information there. The other thing that this election has is uncertainty, which is where misinformation spreads as well. Whenever you have an information vacuum, is what information experts call it, there's going to be kind of bad information that pops up to fill those gaps. So when you think about the fact that we might not know election results for a couple days after the election, you look at that, and that could be a potential vector for misinformation.
Miles, there are so many different actors out there. There are so many different motivations. Obviously, the idea of foreign interference and disinformation has been in all of our heads for 4 years. But what are the other places that this could be coming from and reasons why it could be happening?
Right. So obviously, the foreign interference has not really gone away. Obviously, the federal government and local governments and the social media companies themselves are definitely focused on it more now than they were previously. But there are also politicians who are going to be interested in either sowing doubt in the election results or calling into question about whether a race really happened the way it did for their own political purposes. The other thing to think about, though, when we think about intention, is that a lot of misinformation does not spread on purpose. These elections, our election system in America is so unbelievably complicated. You know, it's possible for you to have a different set of voting rules than someone who lives 10 minutes away from you. And so when you think about it that way, you know, people on your Facebook feed are going to be sharing information. It could be potentially wrong for a bunch of reasons that aren't nefarious. And so I think even when you hear information from a friend or a neighbor, it's still probably best to go double check it against an official source of information.
That was NPR's voting reporter, Miles Parks, who will be back later to talk more about this election.
We also talked to two top election officials, a Republican and a Democrat, and asked them about some of the biggest myths and misconceptions out there.
I am Washington Secretary of State Kim Wyman.
I'm Jocelyn Benson. I am the Secretary of State of Michigan.
Jocelyn Benson and Kim Wyman are from different parties. Benson's a Democrat, Wyman a Republican. But their goals this election cycle are the same. Keep voting safe and secure. Secretary Benson says voters this election cycle are going to need to be vigilant.
Certainly voting in 2020 is different than any other election because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the options that more voters will have to cast their ballots. But certainly in a cycle like this, where we're also seeing voters inundated with misinformation from lots of different sources, their role and our role as election officials is to work together to push back with truth and with facts and with data, with accurate information about the sanctity of the process. And through doing that, we are able to, I believe, successfully protect our elections and our voters from this misinformation.
One misconception the secretaries have had to work hard to fight is that voting by mail lends itself to fraud. Here's Wyman of Washington, which is primarily a mail-in state.
Absolutely. You know, here in Washington State, from the moment the voter drops their ballot back to election officials until the election is certified, are things that create a chain of custody and an audit trail so that if there is any discrepancy in the election, election officials can not only account for every ballot they've received, they can tell you whether or not it's counted, if it was rejected, why the county election board rejected it, and then further, who had access and custody of those ballots during that process. So, you know, any allegations of fraud can be refuted, and we can demonstrate why the election was secure.
Secretary Benson says making the voting process secure will require time and patience from voters. She's prioritizing accuracy over timeliness.
We need more time and we need more machines and more people. Now, we've worked over the past year to do two of those things, get more machines, more high-speed tabulators, and recruit more election workers to operate those tabulators so that we are processing ballots as efficiently as possible. But importantly, our clerks cannot begin processing those ballots until 7 a.m. on election day, which does not give us enough time to process and tabulate those millions of ballots in the 12 hours on that one day, leading to, you know, a point where when the polls close at 8 p.m., we will likely have several hundred thousands, if not millions, more ballots still waiting to be tabulated. And we are going to prioritize accuracy and security every step of the way.
Despite Washington State's long history of mail-in voting, Secretary Wyman says she is still expecting in-person voters, tens of thousands of people who will go to voting centers. So election officials are preparing for that, too.
So those election officials have created curbside pickup. We are allowing voters in counties to stay in their cars and have ballots brought to them. If they need to use an assistive device, they have socially distanced areas that they can do that are safe and secure, and doing the things that everyone is doing across the country, from putting up plexiglass barriers to having our workers wear masks and gloves and having shifts of workers. So half of our election office is working one day, half is working another day, and that way if you do have an outbreak or have an exposure, you're not wiping out the entire workforce. So they've done a lot of things to mitigate our election system here, and I know that's happening across the country.
Okay, so after you vote, you want to know who won. Wyman and Benson say voters should not expect results on election night and that they should be cautious if a candidate claims victory. Here's Wyman.
Candidates on election night often may claim victory, but it doesn't really mean anything until election officials certify those results. And in the November election in our state, that happens at the county level on November 24th, so 21 days after Election Day. And our statewide results will be certified on December 6th by my office. So we actually do have a long window of time to get the right vote, to make sure that it's accurate and correct. Not right in the political sense, but right in the accuracy sense.
You might be surprised to hear it at this point, but part of why Benson and Wyman say they feel so confident in the election process is because they believe in bipartisanship.
we all, as secretaries of state, we work collaboratively across the aisle and in partnership with each other, knowing that our work truly isn't partisan at the end of the day. It's just about making elections work effectively and efficiently for all citizens.
It gets challenging, of course, because each one of us is a partisanly elected official, and some of us are more partisan than others. But overall, I think that we get the bigger picture and are really here trying to make sure that our country has complete confidence and believes the results in the election because it was fair and accurate.
That was Secretary of State Kim Wyman, Republican in Washington, and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, Democrat in Michigan.
One commonly misunderstood part of the election is the role of poll watchers. President Trump has urged his supporters to, quote, go into the polls and watch carefully.
He's claimed they could guard against fraud occurring as voters cast their ballots, but that is not how poll watching works. Pam Fessler is a correspondent on our election security team. Hey, Pam.
Hi, Juana.
All right, so there absolutely are poll watchers, but help us understand, what can they do?
Well, every state has very specific laws and procedures about poll watching, which is something that's been going on for years. And generally, the poll watchers are appointed by the political parties and the campaigns. So, for example, you might have one Republican poll watcher and then a Democrat at a polling site. And their job is basically to monitor what's going on in a very hands-off way to make sure that things are fair. If they see something that's questionable, or maybe there's a voter that they might want to challenge for one reason or another, they're supposed to raise their concerns with the chief poll worker, and that's the person who's in charge of the polling site, to resolve the issue. Poll watchers also can keep track of voter turnout and report back to their respective parties and campaigns so they can get their supporters to come out to the polls. They also monitor the actual counting of votes sometimes. But one thing that poll watchers cannot do is to interfere in the voting process in any way or harass voters. They shouldn't even speak directly to a voter.
So, Pam, you've said that these are folks who are identified and recruited by the parties. Who can be a poll watcher?
Well, really, pretty much anyone, as long as they're registered to vote. Many places also require that poll watchers be trained and actually certified, just to make sure that they understand the rules. I mean, it's not like somebody can just walk in off the street and decide on election day, hey, I want to be a poll watcher. That said, there's always the possibility that people might show up outside a polling place, and they might view themselves as poll watchers, somebody there to make sure that there's no funny business going on. And that's a really big concern this year because of President Trump's allegations that Democrats are trying to steal the election. He's even told his supporters that they should go to the polls and watch what he calls all this, quote, thieving and stealing and robbing. So there are some fears that groups, maybe even armed ones, might show up at the polls and try to disrupt the process. And in fact, a very loud group of Trump supporters showed up at an early voting site last month in Northern Virginia, and some voters said they found that very intimidating.
So if a voter does go to their polling place and they're feeling intimidated as they're trying to cast their ballot, what can they do?
Well, first of all, I suggest that people try to ignore these groups if possible. They can't stop them from voting. The other option is to go to one of the poll workers inside, preferably the one in charge, and report the problem. And they usually have a process in place to deal with this, and that might involve calling law enforcement. There's also a nationwide network of lawyers called Election Protection, who you can contact for help. And as a last resort, a voter might want to call the police directly.
Pam Fessler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Voting in America, an NPR special report. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This election year, the coronavirus pandemic has highlighted and exacerbated barriers to voting. But access problems, intentional and unintentional, have long plagued American politics.
The history of the U.S. is the history of what today we call voter suppression.
Martha Jones studies that history. She told us most barriers to voting do not appear discriminatory on the surface.
Changes to voting rules at the last minute, voter identification requirements, a lack of polling places, and voter education efforts in some but not all neighborhoods.
This is an old approach to voter suppression that rarely, certainly in the 20th century, has voter suppression announced itself expressly as looking to keep, for example, women or Black Americans or Black women from the polls. So we have to look below the surface, is the lesson of history, to discern the intent and the effect of voter suppression and not take its tenets at face value.
Broadly speaking, because there's lots of policies and lots of approaches in place in different states across the country, what are the themes that jump out to you when you talk about that not quite fully announced voter suppression tactics?
I think the most vivid example from our early history is what we call a grandfather clause. So many Americans were subject to literacy tests before they could vote by the end of the 19th century. But there were some Americans who were exceptions to the test, and those were people whose grandfathers had voted before 1868. Nothing about race or gender in that clause, but of course what we know is that before 1868, the grandfathers of Black Americans could not vote because they were enslaved people and kept from the polls categorically.
Now, when you take all of these factors and barriers into consideration, what impact do you think that they collectively have on people's participation? Does it discourage them from showing up?
Voters are, we know, discouraged by the prospect that they will be rebuffed or humiliated or barred from casting ballots. Voters don't show up when there is a likelihood of violence or intimidation at the polling place. We also know that the history of racial violence, lynching in particular, has an effect across generations, an effect that suppresses voter turnout among Black Americans.
I mean, there's also a current of resilience and defiance of all of those attempts as well. Obviously, it's hard to predict what the equation will be, but how do those two cross currents kind of hit each other when you're looking at this broader history and the broader patterns that we've seen over the years?
The way I see it, people who have experienced voter suppression are the greatest champions of voting rights. We learn the value of the vote through the experiences of Black Americans, through the experiences of American women, through the experiences of American felons who are disenfranchised. These are the heroes that tell us the profound meaning, folks who don't take the vote for granted, but in fact have fought for it, are some of the greatest champions of this facet of our democracy.
This year, we have heard President Trump and his allies be quite loud about how perhaps we shouldn't trust mail-in voting, we should not have faith in the process. But at the same time, there has been so much loud and direct messaging from Democrats, including former Vice President Joe Biden, about how this election is the most important election of people's lifetime, and that perhaps even democracy itself is at stake. How do you think that message affects how people are approaching voting?
I think for Black Americans, that's a familiar message or a familiar read on not only what the stakes are, but what the stakes should be. Part of what we know about historically, the ways in which Black Americans have framed any given election is through the tremendous stakes. While I don't want to quibble with Vice President Biden, I want to say that there is a way in which, from my perspective, what Black Americans tell us is that the stakes are high in any given election, in every given election. And this is no different, perhaps, than elections before. It doesn't diminish the significance of this election, but that elections are an opportunity to raise the fundamental profound questions about this country, about its present, and about its future. We would hope that the bar would be precisely that high this year, but it's not the first time that it's been that high.
That was Martha Jones, professor at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. By the way, she told us a story about her own experience voting during the recent primary election. She filled out her mail-in ballot, sealed the envelope.
It was a colleague later that day who happened to mention to me that the last step in casting a mail-in ballot in Maryland is to sign the outside of the envelope, and I gasped because I hadn't done that.
Luckily, the ballot was still sitting on the table by the door.
But it was a lesson to me in the ways in which this is an election year where many of the rules, many of the habits that I had are not going to hold, and that I've got to be attentive to the details if I'm going to cast my ballot successfully in November. And I think that's a lesson for all of us.
You're going to hear us say this a lot over the course of the hour, but every state is different.
So being attentive to the details is hard if those details change from year to year and state to state. In Pennsylvania, one rule that is particularly confusing and enormously important in the 2020 election requires voters to return their ballot inside of a secrecy envelope. If you don't, it's known as a naked ballot.
The state Supreme Court recently ruled that naked ballots will not be counted. Katie Meyer has been covering this issue in Pennsylvania for member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Hey there, Katie.
Hey.
How many other states have similar requirements like this?
It turns out 16 states require secrecy ballots, so the one ballot inside of another type of thing. And a couple other states give counties the option to use them if they want, but it's a minority of states that do this stuff. And it's kind of unclear, you know, how strictly a lot of this stuff is enforced. But a couple of experts I talked to just to get a sense of the situation said a ruling like Pennsylvania's that says you have to invalidate ballots if they don't have the secrecy envelope, that's pretty rare.
One of the challenges here is that Pennsylvania is a state that's pretty new to broader mail-in voting. Do we have a sense of how many people did this the wrong way, didn't put their ballot into two different envelopes during the summer's primary?
Yeah, it's difficult to get a really accurate number, but we did have sort of a red flag raised from the Philadelphia County Commissioners. And they're the ones in charge of elections. And what they said was, based on the numbers of people they've gotten in the past who screwed up the ballot and didn't use the secrecy envelope, they kind of extrapolated that out and said if similar percentages across the state mess it up, we could be looking at around 100,000 ballots being invalidated. And that's the reason why people are kind of freaked out about this, because you'll recall back in 2016, President Trump won Pennsylvania by only 44,000 votes. So it is, you know, not an enormous number of ballots, but it is definitely big enough to change how, you know, the election goes in Pennsylvania. And, you know, as Pennsylvania goes, it's very likely so goes the country.
Right. So that's the stakes here. We're talking about Pennsylvania is probably the most important state, especially for Democrats, if they want to keep Trump from getting 270 electoral votes. I think the third factor here that's worth talking about and why so many Democrats are freaked out about this possibility is the fact that Democrats so far seem to be much more interested in voting by mail, right?
Yeah, that is true. And it's been borne out by polling that we've seen.
What happens next? What sort of plans are out there to avoid that worst case scenario?
So first of all, I'll say that it's always possible, you know, there's a lot of court challenges flying around. There's a lot of legislative stuff being discussed. It's always possible that something could change, but it looks very likely that this is the reality that we are going to have when the election hits. Really, what's up to Democrats now, this is what they're already doing, is they're trying to just let voters know that this is going to be the case, that their ballots will be discarded if they're missing the secrecy envelope. And it's been a fairly robust education campaign. They're putting out little videos on social media. They're paying for ads. They are sending out mailers, things like that. And, you know, experts I've talked to say voters from both parties screw up their ballots at very, very similar rates. So it's not like Democrats have some sort of innate disadvantage here. Again, this is seen as a problem for Democrats just because Democrats are more likely to vote by mail, period.
Katie Meyer, covering politics for WHYY in Philadelphia. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
The number of confusing rules from state to state, even county to county, the essential lack of voting centralization makes voter education crucial. And how you get your information about voting depends very much on where you live and also on who you are.
Christina Jimenez is voting for the first time next month. She's the head of United We Dream, an advocacy group that helps young immigrants. She became a citizen last year.
What I've noticed through the process is the difficulty to know how to register and make sure that you're registered to vote, but also how to make decisions about who you should vote for.
She says many of her own family members are confused about mail-in voting during COVID.
I have found myself like having to really share resources and have phone calls with my tias, with my cousins, and walking them step by step on this.
It's a problem that exposes stark inequities in voter education.
What is outrageous is that the political parties have not really invested in engaging a massive amount of voters, particularly in communities of color, in Spanish-speaking communities, and immigrant communities overall.
Keith Ivey hopes to vote next month, too. He served 8.5 years in prison for property crimes. He lives in Florida, which restored voting rights to felons with an amendment to the state constitution in 2018.
Ivy was thrilled until the governor signed a bill requiring felons to pay court fees before they're allowed to vote. Now, he says he can't even find out how much he owes.
I have a voter's registration card, but I know I have a fee or a fine somewhere out there. I don't know the amount. I don't know where to pay it. So even if I did find out how much it is right now, I still wouldn't know where to go pay it at. And then on top of that, the law. You don't want to break the law by voting ineligible.
There have been challenges to the rule. A district court judge called the requirement essentially a poll tax and therefore unconstitutional. But an appeals court said it did not violate any constitutional rights and overruled the decision last month, putting Ivy's vote in jeopardy.
That was a major setback. So just trying to strap on our boots and keep plugging away at it. That's what I'm doing personally. I believe I'll be successful. Don't know when. Don't know if I'll be able to vote in this next election. So that's a huge, huge deal for me.
That was Keith Ivey and Christina Jimenez.
We want to take some time now to answer your questions, specifically about mail-in voting.
And here to help us is Edgardo Cortez, who works as an election security advisor for the Brennan Center for Justice and is a former Virginia Commissioner of Elections. Hey there.
Hello.
So let's start listening to some of these questions.
This is Betsy Alice from Michigan. I applied to receive a mail-in ballot. My question is, if I change my mind and decide to go in person to the polls, will that create an issue?
I mean, I think a lot of people aren't 100% sure yet whether they want to go in person or want to vote by mail. What would you tell somebody like Betsy?
So I think the issue of if you get a ballot in the mail and whether or not or how you can go to vote in person does vary a lot by state. In Betsy's case, she's noted she's from Michigan. So if she has her ballot and hasn't returned it yet, in Michigan, she can take it to the polling place and she'll be issued a new ballot to just vote regularly in person. If she never receives it or she loses the ballot, she can still vote in person, but she'll have to fill out some paperwork. But again, that'll vary a lot by state. And so I think the important thing is check in with your kind of state and local election offices about the best options for you to deal with those situations.
I think one thing that we can say is definitely clear no matter where you live is you can't mail in or submit your mail-in ballot and also vote in person. That's something you are not allowed to do despite some recent commentary on that front by the president.
That's correct. Regardless of the state, you're only entitled to vote once, and states have mechanisms in place to make sure that you don't do what was just described in terms of sending in a ballot by mail and also going in person. You still, you know, there will only be one vote counted per voter.
All right, let's go to our next question. It's Mary in Minnesota.
I was wondering if you request a mail-in ballot, can we personally deliver it to our polling place on election day?
So Mary's got a great question. In Minnesota, she does not have the option to drop it off at her polling place on election day, but she can drop it off at her local election office until 3 p.m. on election day. And so, again, this is something that varies a lot by state. Some states will allow you to drop it off at your polling place. Other states have drop boxes or in-person drop-off locations in advance of the election. So there are options that vary a lot by state.
All right, let's listen to one more question. This is from John in Wyoming.
I plan to vote by mail and have requested a mail-in ballot from the elections office in my home county. I'm concerned that with the flood of mail-in ballots, that mine will somehow be disqualified. So my question is, how can I confirm that my vote has been counted?
I think this is something a lot of people are worried about, whether it's nefarious or whether it's just the post office dealing with a ton of ballots and the fact that the mail sometimes takes a few days. Understanding that obviously, again, we're going to say it again because it's important, it's different from state to state. What's the best approach for somebody like John?
For John, who lives in Wyoming, the Wyoming Secretary of State's office recommends contacting your county clerk to check the status of your absentee ballot. A number of states have set up ballot tracking access so that you can log into a site online and find out, you know, where your ballot is in the process. The other thing for a lot of voters, you know, this issue of having your mail-in ballot disqualified, we're really encouraging voters, especially those that are voting by mail the first time. It is a different process than going to vote in person. So make sure that you are looking at the instructions that come with your ballot so that you're, in addition to filling out the ballot, that envelope that it goes back in has all of the information that the election official is going to need in order to count your ballot.
I am sure, given how top of mind this is for so many people and given your expertise, you're probably answering a lot of these questions from your family and your friends and people who know what you do. What would you say the most common advice that you are telling everybody who gets in touch with you is right now?
So I think the most common advice is, number one, make sure that your voter registration information is up to date. I think the second thing is, especially if you are planning to vote and request a ballot by mail, that you request it as early as possible. I think it will give voters a peace of mind, but it also helps election officials in terms of being able to process everything in the lead up to and on election day.
Edgardo Cortez, an advisor with the election security team at the Brennan Center and a former Virginia Commissioner of Elections, thank you so much for joining us and answering these important questions.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Early voting continues in most states this month, and turnout in some places has hit record highs.
At the Government Center in Fairfax, Virginia, weeks before Election Day, polling locations are crowded.
Brought a chair, I got water, I got pretzels, I got coffee. I'm ready.
Mary Joyce Kemper is 77 years old. She's staring at an epic line.
Just got here a little while ago, but somebody who was over there said that when I was standing there, and she said, I just want you to know that from where you're standing to where I'm standing is about 50 minutes.
Kemper is determined to vote in person anyway.
You know, I don't want any argument. My vote's going to count. I don't want any argument.
Lee Ping Hudson has been waiting in line with her husband, Ted, for almost an hour. He has an absentee ballot, but she really wants to vote in person and says it's actually been a pretty positive experience.
For me, I keep looking at people and I see people line up, give me courage. I feel encouraged that people, you know, value their vote. They come out ready to spend the time in the line. And I look at people in front of me, behind me, they all wait peacefully, patiently. And I see the security guard, the lady tried to cheer everybody up. I'm encouraged.
Malika Suri, who's 22, says this election is important and is glad she's able to fit voting in around a new schedule.
I start work in like 2 weeks, so I'm really glad they did this early voting so that I could actually come out and like spend my day doing this.
Malika, who's in slippers, says she wasn't expecting the line to be this long, but she's sticking it out anyway.
We've gotten a ton of questions from people around the country who are still trying to figure out their plans for voting this year. To help answer some of them, we talked to Wisdom Cole, the National Organizing Manager for the Youth and College Division of the NAACP. The first question comes from Chris in Chicago.
I'm concerned about the many, many people who have been displaced in the recent natural disasters. How will they vote if they're sheltering so far from their polling places, or if their mail-in ballots are sent to a home that is no longer standing? What are we doing to help them exercise their right to vote?
That's a difficult thing, and that's something that we're actually facing all across the country, particularly looking at college campuses where some students are actually being sent home or being asked to stay in place, and their ballots are being delivered to the campus, but not being forwarded to the address they're actually at. And so it's really important that we have people verify their voter registration status to see, hey, am I actually registered to vote in the place that I think that I'm actually going to be voting at?
And if people are wanting to check their voter registration status, figure out where they're registered, is there an easy place for them to go or a way for them to do that?
Oh, yeah, super, super easy. We actually have a partnership with vote.org, which allows us to register people to vote, but actually verify their registration status first, and then it prompts them to register or re-register if their registration is not at the place they think it is.
Got another question. This one is from Sarah, who is in Buffalo, New York.
Hi, my name is Sarah Walsh, calling from Buffalo. My question is, what happens if you end up becoming COVID-19 positive or sick with COVID-19 when it's time to vote and you haven't already requested an absentee ballot? Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, no, that's a really tough situation. And so I think make a voting plan and plan to vote early, right? We know that there are essential workers. There are people who are working at bars, some of the nightclubs that are reopened, some of the spaces that have been opening in the different phases that each state is at. And so recognizing that we don't necessarily know exactly what's going to happen again, we do know or we've been hearing that there's going to be a spike happening of COVID again. And so thinking ahead of time to prepare for whatever results happen or whatever may happen on election day.
Wisdom, you spend a lot of time talking with all kinds of young voters, and I know that every time we have an election roll around, there's this conversation where people say, you know, we do a lot of outreach to young voters, but they don't show up. When you think about the young people that you're talking to, what kind of concerns have they raised and what kind of barriers to access are they facing?
Yeah, for young voters, and particularly thinking about young Black voters, we've seen corrupt politicians. We've seen elections being stolen. We've seen polling locations being closed in front of our eyes. In Georgia, you know, we're seeing people being arrested at the polls for just trying to vote. And so, you know, all the time they're saying young people don't care about the vote, but you're not speaking to the issues that are most important to us, such as gun violence, such as student debt, HBCU students not being able to get their absentee ballots because of the campuses that they're at. We're involved. We're talking about these things. We're doing things about it in our community. But if we want people to turn out to vote, we got to make sure we're speaking to them at the level that they're at and what issues speak to their lives.
Wisdom Cole is the National Organizing Manager for the NAACP Youth and College Division. Wisdom, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Juana.
And back at the polling site in Virginia, where the lines were out the door, another thing on everybody's mind was, of course, the coronavirus.
Patty Meek is 58.
I think that people need to be cautious. Of course, I'm a public health nurse. And for me, I'm just actually getting through cancer. As a matter of fact, I just had like reconstructive surgery on September the 11th. And of course, surgery does put you a little bit more at risk.
Meek says she's being really careful. She felt it was important to show up in person this year.
A lot of people have died. In my case, you know, Black people, women have died for this right to vote. So it's worth it for me to take the risk. But again, I'm being very careful, of course.
We wanted to know exactly how big a risk it is to vote in person.
So we asked Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Public Health School at Brown University.
Yeah, so polling places can be very safe as long as they're set up right, as long as there's good ventilation, as long as everybody's wearing a mask, as long as people are well spaced out. Polling places can be every bit as safe as a grocery store, maybe even more so.
What should somebody be thinking about if they're deciding, does it make more sense to actually go and vote the way I'm used to, or should I think about doing this by mail?
So one of the key things is to think about the fact that most of the lines for voting will be outside. So you have to ask yourself, what's the weather like outside? Is it going to be really cold? Will it be raining? As long as you can be pretty comfortable and warm outside, you can stay safe. And then inside the polling booth, again, as long as there is good social distancing, definitely need to wear a mask, make sure everybody else is wearing a mask. It can be safe even for people who are high risk, who are elderly. There are ways of making it a very low risk activity.
If you were advising a county on how to set up their polling locations, what are the most important precautions that they can put in place and can easily do to make sure things are safer?
Yeah, so what I've been advising counties and places that are setting up polling booths is make sure there's good ventilation inside the polling space. So, and that can mean simply is just make sure the windows are open so that there's good airflow. Keep the polling booths reasonably well spaced apart so that people are not right next to each other. The workers there should definitely be wearing masks. And then have a place where people can wait outside. And again, you have to think about how do you do that safely on a sidewalk. If you can provide heating, if you can provide warm coffee or cider, that's, of course, always a bonus. But helping people stay warm outside is another key part of making the whole experience not too painful for voters.
One of the things we've talked a lot about is how so many perceptions of what is safe and what is not safe really locked into people's brains early on, before we had a full understanding of how the coronavirus spreads, before we realized that some of our initial instincts might have been actually wrong. And I think a lot of people have these memories of primary voting in places like Wisconsin, where people were frankly terrified to show up in person. What's the biggest difference between the spring in terms of the idea of, can a group of people showing up to vote in one location be a safe activity?
Yeah, so we've learned a lot since the spring. The biggest things that we've learned are that being outside is really pretty safe, especially if people are wearing masks, and that surfaces are not a major source of spread. So I wouldn't go crazy trying to clean every booth. Definitely want to have hand sanitizer around, sanitize your hands before you go into a booth, sanitize after. But we don't need any aggressive cleaning protocol. So I do think that we've learned a lot about how to make voting safer than what we knew 5 months ago.
Finally, can I ask what method you plan on using to vote?
I plan to vote in person. Though, of course, I do believe mail-in ballots should be an option for people. I think I can vote safely, and I plan to vote in Massachusetts on Election Day.
Dr. Ashish Jha, the Dean of Brown University School of Public Health, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we're joined again by NPR voting reporter Miles Parks, who's going to help us take a look toward the final weeks of this election and the future of voting in America. Hello again, Miles.
Hello.
So, Miles, we are now in the final weeks ahead of Election Day. Say you're someone who has not done any research yet, you haven't made a plan. What's the most important thing to do first?
I think what's important to remember about, no matter which way you want to vote, the first thing you got to do is register, regardless of whether you're thinking you want to vote by mail or vote in person. And in most states, you can do this online. So go to your local elections website, usually just Google what county you live in, and then elections, and you'll be brought to that website. The other two places I would say have really good places for information on how to get registered and honestly how to get through all of this process, vote.org, and also the Washington Post has honestly one of the best, most user-friendly ways to get information on how to register.
Let's just talk broadly here, Miles. How different is Election Day going to be given all of these factors we've been talking about?
It's going to be wildly different. And honestly, anyone who says they know exactly what Election Day is going to look like at this point, no matter how long they've been studying this stuff, is lying. And I think when we talk about in-person voting, it's important to remember that even if it is, you're thinking, oh, I've in-person voted in the last 10 elections and I've lived in the same house. So, you know, maybe this pandemic's affecting other people's votes, but I'm just going to do it the same way I've always have. That might not work this time. You know, election officials are in this position where they're having to change locations on a whim. They're trying to recruit more poll workers. And so you really have to double check, A, your registration status, and B, your precinct, where you are supposed to vote, because maybe your election official hoped that that place would be available, but maybe the space didn't allow for proper social distancing, or they couldn't recruit enough poll workers to open that location. There's going to be a lot more usage of these things called kind of super precincts or mega precincts, where there are places that in some states that have never used them before, basically anyone in a jurisdiction can show up at any place and potentially cast a ballot. So there's going to be a lot of new stuff, even for people who are voting in person, and people who've done it a lot of times still might encounter new stuff.
You know, Miles, when we have this conversation, I can't stop thinking about what we heard former First Lady Michelle Obama say at the DNC, you know, to bring that bag lunch, to wear those comfortable shoes, and be prepared if you go in person to perhaps wait for a long time. We know that even when we're not talking about voting in a pandemic, there are often long lines. But this year in particular, how long should voters be prepared to wait?
Yeah, it's hard to guess, which I think is why you hear that messaging, especially from politicians that kind of want to get into voters' heads, that kind of assume the worst but hope for the best, right? We have data from polls we've conducted at NPR Marist polls that show that most people on a whole in previous elections don't wait longer than 15 or 30 minutes to vote. So we know that data point, but we also know that things are changing so rapidly that we can't say for sure that's going to stay true. I think one big tip on the long lines front is we also know that the time when polling centers are most crowded is early in the morning, first thing in the morning. And so I think people have this misconception that if they show up right when the polls open, that it's going to be easier for them to vote and they might be able to jump in there before they have to work. In reality, if you can spare a few minutes, maybe later in the day, we know that on a whole, polls get less busy at once that early morning rush kind of subsides.
So, Miles, say as voters, we've done all the things. We've chosen how we're going to vote. We've made that plan. We've executed the plan. What do we need to do, if anything, after the fact to know the results of our state and local and national elections?
A couple things, I'd say, can make you really well-equipped once you actually have cast your ballot. First of all, a lot of states that are doing vote by mail for the first time are also instituting this thing where you can check online whether your ballot was received, which I think can make people feel a little bit better to actually see, you know, your elections office saying, we've received your ballot, it's in line to be counted. The other thing I'd say is that we know that there are tens of millions of people out there who are going to be voting in a way they've never voted before. And so if you have made a call to your election official and you have good information that is reliable, that you know, you found out the parking situation at your local precinct, really think about being forward with that information with your community. Think about texting some of your friends and think about communicating that, because we know there is the potential that people are going to be more confused this time around.
So we're giving a lot of practical tips to listeners. I feel like we should give a mental health tip as well. And that is that this is an election that is going to be much more complicated than usual. This is an election that's going to have results that may come in a lot slower than usual because vote by mail ballots might be counted a couple days after election day, depending on your state. Is social media the place to seek out information, to monitor information, especially in those murky hours after the polls have closed and results, incomplete results, are starting to come in?
Absolutely not. The problem with social media is that it has this way of making isolated incidents seem systemic. And that is a huge problem for kind of the legitimacy of our elections. You know, if you see one person who's had a horrible experience, but maybe you're not hearing from the, you know, tens of thousands of people who may have voted at that same place and had a great experience. And so you kind of have to try to mute some of the noise, go to your reputable news sources, and then as those results start coming in, understand that this process is going to take a little bit longer to kind of unravel than in previous years, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we even should be kind of getting away from using the word delay, because the election results you see on election night have never been the official results. Those are unofficial results that are based on statistical projections. These election races have always been certified weeks after the election. And so by having those unofficial results just take a little bit longer to calculate, that really shouldn't be a problem for people. People should be expecting that.
Miles, I realize the next thing I'm about to ask you is a little unanswerable in some ways, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm curious, given everything that we're seeing this year that looks so different than elections we've seen in the past, what does this tell us about the future of voting?
I think we will know a lot more on November 4th or December 4th, or as we get more results about how people actually reacted to all of these changes. I think the biggest thing I'm going to be watching for when we look ahead to future elections is, you know, we know the amount of mail ballots that are going to be used this time around is going to double from any election in recent memory. You know, we were at about 25% in 2018. We're looking at potentially 50% or more. And so we also know that in voting, it's really hard to give people new opportunities and then to take them back. We've seen in emergency situations before when, you know, voting centers have been offered or when more early voting than usual has been offered. A lot of times voters then kind of request those things to kind of continue. So we'll be kind of on the lookout to see, does this lead to an uptick in more mail voting nationwide? And then on that same thread, we're still watching to see how much more mail voting increases voter participation, turnout, you know? And so we're going to be looking at what the turnout numbers are here. And if there is a huge uptick in the amount of mail voting that's available in this nation, does it lead to higher turnout rates?
And have you heard any jurisdictions say whether they're going to still have I voted stickers given the pandemic circumstances?
There are a lot of jurisdictions mailing I voted stickers with their mail ballots. So you don't, if you decide you want to vote by mail, that's probably something that you can still acquire. I will say, I don't want to tell people to do this, but I know that there are ways you could purchase those things online. And so if I know,
what?
I know, it's not as good, But if there is, you know, maybe you want to get a group of your friends together and they don't have a way to get them and you want to encourage them to vote, there are other ways. Or you can, you know, make your own I voted sticker yourself. Draw it with some crayons or something like that.
That is Miles Parks from our election team. Thanks so much, Miles.
Thank you for having me.
For more guides and information on voting, you can check out our political coverage at npr.org and our voting guide at LifeKit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks so much to our election security team, Miles Parks, Pam Fessler, and Brett Neely, and to supervising political editor Arnie Seipel.
This special was edited by Barry Hardiman and Samantha Balaban.
It was produced by Christina Calla, Barbara Sprunt, and Mia Venkat. Sarah Gilbert is Vice President of News Programming. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. This is Voting in America, an NPR special report. Thanks for listening.
And join us tomorrow morning. We will be back right here for Up First.
Voting is crucial. And I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this a man?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Listen now.